The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies held its fourth Psychedelic Science Conference in Denver, Colorado, June 19th through 23rd. According to news reports, some 11 or 12,000 people attended. I grew up in a town of 16,000. I've never liked crowds. In many ways, I'm kind of glad I missed it. And, you know, just between you, me, and the fence post, dear listener, some of those business people and venture capitalists who've been getting into the newly legal drugs business, well, you could say they're not my cup of tea. You could say they make my skin crawl. You'd be a little closer to the mark. But I digress. My point, I'm not really sorry that I missed PsyCon, though I am kind of sorry that I missed the closing ceremony. It was supposed to be remarks by my old friend Rick Doblin, the founder and executive director of MAPS. He was up on the big stage starting to do the closing rah-rah, and then this happened.
Now is not the time, I don't think. But we will hear you, we will listen, and we'll try our best to respond. Not right now, you're right. I think that we need a dialogue and a long forum. It's okay. But I think that now is not the time. I'd ask you to respect me, and I will respect you. So, okay, we've tried to include as many. Okay. We've tried to be as inclusive as we could be. I'm sure I believe in dialogue, but I don't. Okay, I don't know. I can't respond in this kind of way. I can't even hear what you're saying. That we'll listen to all of your concerns and we'll do our best. I do think it's a big community, and I think that there's going to be a lot of challenges going ahead. And I think one of the more important ways that we can go ahead, I would ask you to let me speak. How about this? If I give you 1 minute to say what you want to say, then let me speak. Would you like to do that? Come on up. Come on up. So fine. We may go over time a little bit, but... Okay. So just come up and just very briefly say what your concerns are. And...
space right now.
And as a consequence,
consequence if you don't liberate the people who are most marginalized in their own land, sovereign nations. You can't liberate anybody.
Okay, we will. That's a good point. We have an oppressive culture, and we will do our best.
You're not. Nobody owns healing, but you know what? You don't own our culture. You can't take it from us.
We don't.
And we deserve respect. Where are the investors investing in land, that water right? Where? Where?
Okay.
No.
Okay.
No. He has had all weekend.
Okay.
If you don't like this, then maybe you should go look back in your roots and find out where colonization happened that created this world where you don't want your people.
Okay, that's enough. Okay. Go right ahead.
I just came from.
No, go ahead. Yeah, no, thank you.
By Hermann Trimelden before that, there was a panel on Peyote and the history and exploitation.
So hard to be in front of here. This is very challenging. I want you to be aware that you have been deceived by this movement. The psychedelic renaissance is not really a psychedelic renaissance. The psychedelics MDMA is something that is just created a few decades ago. It's not renaissance at all. The plant medicine is renaissance within the Western system, and it has been happening for decades through the indigenous people. We open our medicines for you to heal, not to take, not to extract. So this movement is not a renaissance. It's been happening already for a long time, and it's being appropriated. Our renaissance, bringing the medicines for you to heal. You're taking it, you're colonizing it, you're damaging us, you're killing and erasing our cultures. Please stop. Think critically. This is not okay. You've been deceived, and you're going to continue being deceived. The same happened to tobacco, now causes cancer. The same happened to opioids, now causes addiction. The same happened to coca, now cocaine causes a lot of harm. Please look at the cycle of colonization and how this continues to happen. In 20, 30 decades from now, you're going to see the medicine harming you because they're living beings and they don't like to be abused. They're going to come back to you and harm you. We're here because we love you. We're here because we don't want you to harm yourself. We love you. I love myself. I love my tradition. I love the earth. And we need to stand in liberation together. This is not a collective liberation movement. This is a capitalization. And you're stepping on our lands. You're stepping on our medicines for you to heal what you're oppressing us when you're killing us. Please just stop. Please think. Have conversations, including us. The beautiful woman before said we want to include indigenous voices.
What voices are indigenous? Enough. Okay.
The people that need hearing the most is the BIPOC community. We can't afford it. We are the ones that need to be in the front line getting this healing. Why are we not getting this healing? Yes, thank you for the scholarship. I appreciate you, but we're the ones that need the healing. I come from the hood. People in the hood don't get the healing they need. They can't afford even the tax.
What we can do is to use that to work together and to listen to the Indigenous elders.
That was from the end of the Psychedelic Science Conference that was held by MAPS in Denver, Colorado last month. The video can be found easily on YouTube. It's also been posted to Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, you know, all the other socials. There was one more person who spoke at the end of the protest, but the sound just, they were barely audible, and amplifying the YouTube audio, the sound quality was just, anyway, if you can hear it, you can find the video in its entirety on YouTube. Just search for Psychedelic Science Protest. Actually, you can find a few different copies of that video. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Every year, June 26th is the Global Day of Action for the Support Don't Punish campaign. Events were held all over the world. Marches, demonstrations, other events, teach-ins, panel discussions. Open Society Foundations held an online event on June 26th entitled Drug Decriminalization, From Punitive Policies to Effective Solutions. Let's hear a couple of the speakers. Lawrence Grandprix is Director of Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle.
My name is Lawrence Grandprix. I'm Director of Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We go by our initials LBS. We're a grassroots think tank out of Baltimore. We're not a nonprofit. We made a very intentional decision to not be a nonprofit based upon conversation with our elders in terms of the political energy of the 60s and 70s being co-opted in many ways by the professionalization of advocacy. So we operate from a very explicit community control, Black sovereignty, Black nationalist, Pan-African liberationist perspective. And we've been able to have some very concrete policy victories here in Maryland. We've been able to stop the construction of a youth jail. We overturned the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights, which gave cops immunity from internal discipline. And we just passed cannabis reparations, so the money from the war on drugs and legalization of cannabis would go to communities impacted by the war on drugs. So when OSF came to us to join the Decrim Advocacy Coalition, we said, no, that's not what we do. We choose for ourselves our own mechanisms of advocacy. And if people want to fund that, that's great. But we know what we got to do, and we do it whether people fund us or not. But I had conversations with folks, and I gave them what I call the standard narrative of decrim. You know, people cycle in and out of prisons, decreases their tolerance, overdoses spiking, toxic drug supply, arrest costs money, we'll reinvest the money once we decrim. They said cool, but they weren't really persuaded by it. This report is an attempt by myself and our research team to understand that, because it's not going to pass in Maryland until we understand that. Maryland's a 30% Black state, it's a Democratic trifecta. And under that Democratic trifecta, the percentage of Black folks incarcerated relative to white folks have increased to be one of the highest in the nation. We designed a research agenda designed to use qualitative research and analysis from our experience uniquely working with Black civil society, begin to interrogate the narratives around decrim, how people see the impact of the war on drugs in terms of the impacts on community. We talk a lot about individuals incarcerated, individual loss of freedom, individual deaths. Decrim advocates have not been great in talking about communal impacts. The communal sovereignty that's taken away, not just by the war on drugs, but also the nonprofit industrial complex taking away the ability for communities to define for themselves the mechanisms of liberation and services provision that they see as adequate for their community. So as a working class Black person in Baltimore, we've typically been the subjects of research and not the objects choosing how research happens. So we made a very intentional decision to flip that dynamic in this research project. I was a primary consultant. My co-author, Natalie Flace, and research assistant, Judith Parks, were at University of Maryland. So I basically designed a lot of the research proposal agenda, gave them research interview subjects, and helped them interpret the data, but they did a lot of the writing. I did the introduction, executive summary, and the postscript. And that we did around a literature review, an extensive literature review, examining how dominant academic literature talks about social capital in relation to people going through treatment services and addiction, trying to see if they had any theories for us to conceptualize what we wanted to focus on, which was the communal impacts of the war on drugs, how to build community sovereignty through the provision of services. Long story short, there wasn't much there. So we relied heavily on qualitative research to produce some theories about how to reframe drug decriminalization from an agenda more focused around community self-determination. So our findings were thus. In drug policy, there's a notion of freedom that many scholars, including Norfolk University Professor Charles Mills, calls negative freedom. You want the government to get off of your back, let you use drugs if you want to, not lock you up, et cetera, et cetera. This negative freedom was important, but was not nearly as important as a positive freedom to use the tools of governance to invest in communities to produce the institutions that better people's lives. Additionally, not only was drug decriminalization not inherently tied with producing positive freedom, The dominant institutions, the dominant narratives, the dominant theories tied to drug decriminalization, given the experiences of people in Baltimore, a cross-section of people who do addiction services, but also work with children, faith leaders, elders, an intentional, non-traditional cross-section outside of people who were just directly impacted by drugs through drug use, said that putting more money into nonprofit ecosystems not only does not inherently create community sovereignty, it can oftentimes decrease community sovereignty by forcing people to depend on institutions that are exogenous to community for the institutions they need to survive. And as opposed to building the community cohesion and community power, oftentimes that community cohesion and power is shredded by the very forms of investment many decrim advocates see as a solution to the community, negative community impacts of war on drugs. So the report includes many quotes. I don't have time to read all of them, but I do just want to read one. This is from a middle-aged Black woman who works in addiction services. I've worked in recovery homes, drug court programs, in and outpatient medication management programs everywhere. The truth of the matter is that it's driven by money. How much time is it going to take for someone to move through our treatment protocols so that we can say that we prove to the state that we are meeting our goals, we can prove we deserve more money than the university? How much money do we have to do things, take clients into community, or to do things socially with clients? How much of the creation of alternative programming is going to take away from this primary programming that we feel is more efficacious than whatever the alternative programming is, and is more in line with the potential funding sources? The drive, of course, is more about how do we keep our jobs? How do we keep the money coming in? So this is an extension of a larger critique of our organization of nonprofit industrial complex. We've taken many actions in Baltimore to have grassroots community control of funding, things like the Baltimore Slave Children and Youth Fund, things like the Community Restoration Fund. We're going to have a reparations commission in Baltimore to examine the impacts of war on drugs and to use the funding from state cannabis sales to go directly to local control so the individuals and community can choose for themselves how to spend it. And it's because we have heard comments like this for decades. It's why we do what we do as 30-ish year old Black people, given the lessons from our elders, that given the nature of white supremacy in America, it's very difficult, not just for conservative white racists, but also white liberals, to invest Black people with a vision that they themselves have the ability to be their own solutions. There was a notion given to us from our interviewees that they have experienced relationships with funders, foundations, nonprofit policy advocates, that view community as too broken, too traumatized, to essentially be able to wield power for itself. And as long as that was the dominant conceptual framework, they would not trust that the money that would be saved through decrim would ever go to them. Additionally, they had a hard time believing that people who have historically operationalized these racist perspectives towards them could seriously operationalize a policy agenda to reverse the criminalization of Black people. So having a simple rhetorical commitment to reverse criminalization through the lens of arrest on drugs did not resonate, because many of these people have been working on police accountability for years. And they say, well, I don't see the drug policy people there with me. Many of these people have been working for community control of policing for years. And they say, well, I don't see the drug policy people there with me. So they don't seem to be so interested in criminalization as a whole. They seem interested in this very particular slice of criminalization relative to their policy areas. And also possibly they could get themselves money once decrim becomes a thing. So we operationalize these perspectives, not just to critique drug decrim, but to really make the argument that in a state that's 30% Black, with the largest Black caucus in America, you are not going to pass decriminalization until you actually talk to grassroots Black community folks and give them a vision of investment and communal empowerment they can believe and buy into. We talk to not just lawmakers, but also people in community. They have what I call community criminal justice reform fatigue. And to roughly define that, things like the Justice Reinvestment Act, which claims to reinvest money in community, nowhere in America was that money actually reinvested in grassroots preventative services based upon academic analysis. So policymakers and people in community are saying things like, look, y'all keep talking about letting people out of jail. I get that that's what y'all want, but we're not in jail for drug possession for a long period of time. We're in jail for things like carrying guns because we have to sell drugs to feed our families, and y'all don't seem to want to talk about that because that's not a perfect victim. Similarly, y'all keep talking about getting people out of jail, and you're right. They spend less money incarcerating us, but we never see the reinvestment. They don't want to spend money on us at all for anything. So y'all just want to do the stuff which is acceptable, but never actually talk about going upstream in terms of investing in job creation, entrepreneurship, community institution building that will actually solve the root causes why people become addicted in the first place. And until you become interested in that, I may not have a lot of time for this Ephraim stuff because there's a political liability. We have a lot of conservative Black elders who remember Iran-Contra, the feeling that drugs were flooded into our community to disrupt the Black community, and therefore don't inherently see policy liberalization as a progressive measure, because they understand the ability for drugs to impact the community and disrupt the cohesion. Simply saying that that's not the intent and that's not going to happen does not deal with the decades of mistrust built up by Black community and Black civil society. So we're using the report to have conversations around these dynamics, using the report to have conversations within Black service providers to build up a liberatory movement for them to demand reinvestment. And then we want Ephraim to plug into that. So as opposed to using the big flashy number on money saved, to then rally people around that and hope the money gets reinvested, we're saying flip it. Build the investment in Black civil society, grassroots human social providers, and then have Ephraim plug into that. That's how you get this passed in Maryland. Thank you.
That was Lawrence Grand Prix, Director of Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Megan Sway is Policy Director at the American Civil Liberties Union of Maine.
Last year, we released a report together with the Maine Center for Economic Policy. It's called A Better Path for Maine, The Case for Decriminalizing Drugs. And this report brought together three different perspectives. I brought the legal and policy perspective. I've been a lawyer for 15 years now. With the James Mile from the Maine Center for Economic Policy, he brought his economic expertise. And then the lead author was Winifred Tate, who's an anthropologist at Colby College and leads the Colby College Drug Policy Lab. Together, we wrote a report that tries to contextualize the war on people who use drugs in Maine. How did we go from sort of a state that was on the forefront of alcohol prohibition last century to a state that is on the forefront of pushing for decriminalization this century? As most social movements for progress are, there have been pendulum swings, and this report was an attempt to swing the pendulum in the way we wanted to go. So in 1976, Maine decriminalized the possession of personal use amounts of cannabis. But from there, we've then become one of the states with one of the highest deadly overdose rates in the country. As prohibition and criminalization progresses, each drug is criminalized, pushing people to seek other drugs and making the drug supply more deadly. So part of our report was walking through that process of how criminalization makes the drug supply more deadly. It also contextualizes why people use drugs, how this image that we have that people are using drugs, if you use drugs once, you are addicted forever and sort of dispensable by society is just completely untrue. And then we look at the cost, both the costs economically and socially to criminalizing people who use drugs. So Maine is a state of about 1.3 million people. But we spend $111 million a year criminalizing people who use drugs. We looked at the cost. A single drug arrest costs about just under $8,500. What else do we spend that much money on? That is two-thirds the cost of what we spend for a single kid's public school education. So we're spending as much on one drug arrest as almost we spend on an entire year of public school education for kids. That amount could buy 7 months of rent in the most expensive county in the state, and it could pay for several months of intensive outpatient treatment for someone with substance use disorder. Trying to look at this from different ways, you know, what are ways that we could spend this money in a better way that would lead to healthier societies? We're in the midst of this pendulum swing. In 2019, we introduced a bill in the Maine legislature to decriminalize possession of under 3.5 grams of all drugs. That bill did not pass because then the COVID lockdown happened. But then we came back in 2021 and the House of Representatives passed a bill that would decriminalize drugs. We now have another bill that will be going forward in January again, to decriminalize drugs. Another thing we talk about at length in this report is not just the economic cost, but the social cost. We talk about how criminalization derails lives and can be deadly. We talk at length about how both, you know, prohibition started as a racist project and the war on drugs as a racist project. And Maine is the oldest, whitest state in the country. And the people who are targeted and most harmed are still folks of color, especially Black people in Maine. We talk a lot about how this is a choice that state policymakers are making. This is a choice to invest in failed methods of social control instead of investing in things that help people lead healthier lives, that help interconnectedness, that build communities. We also talk about how the legal system is not built to address problematic drug use and can never be the solution we're looking for. As Maine has seen increased overdose death rates, there's been a real turn towards drug courts, towards a gentler approach to punishing, attempting to punish people out of drug use. And we go through in the report how that just is not something that is ever going to work on a scale that leads to a healthy state. And then finally, we end with what is the policy recommendation? And the policy recommendation, first and foremost, is to decriminalize drugs, but also to take the money that we are spending to punish people and reinvest it in ways that help people, that give people the foundation they need for community, for health, for connectedness. And that is what will lead us to reducing overdose deaths, to reducing this despair, to ending the cycle of keeping people in a permanent status, revolving in and out of the criminal legal system instead of staying in their community. So these are all messages in the report that we focus on, and we are using the report to speak to press, to lawmakers, but also to speak with our communities, to talk with folks. You know, it's anecdotal, but in Maine, almost everyone has been touched by a fatal drug overdose. Almost all of us have loved people who have died. And we see an opening up of the conversation of what might it look like to not try to punish our way out of this. And we're using this report to try to bolster those arguments and to take a crack at that opening in people's hearts to look at ways that we could not focus on punishment, but instead focus on support.
That was Megan Sway, Policy Director at the ACLU of Maine, speaking at an event sponsored by Open Society Foundations entitled Drug Decriminalization, From Punitive Policies to Effective Solutions, that was held June 26th. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now,
for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.